Salam. For example, in verse 49 of Surah Ali Imran, God Almighty quotes the Prophet Jesus, Allah Nabiyyina wa Alihi wa Alayhi Salam, to say the following, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Inni akhluqu lakum min at-tini ka hay'ati at-tayri fa anfukhu fihi fa yakunu tayran bi idhnillah. Prophet Jesus alayhi salam said, verily or surely I create for you from dust or from mud the form of a bird. I blow into it and so it becomes a bird by the permission of God. Wa ubri'ul akmaha wal abrasa. This is part of the verse which is relevant to our discussion. He says, and I cure with the permission of God the blind and the person with leprosy. Wa uhyil mauta bi'idhnillah. This last part of the verse could also be used to help answer the question that we're talking about. Prophet Jesus says, and I revive and bring back to life the dead person. If a person can bring somebody who's dead back to life, why isn't it not possible for a person to cure a person from an ailment? Of course, bi-iznillah, with the permission of God. Therefore, the idea that another human being could grant, could heal another person by the permission of God from ailment is something which is affirmed and established in these verses of the Holy Quran. Therefore, it's also equally likely to be established for the family of the prophets, the imams, because as we know, the imams were equal in stature, were greater than the prophets of the other Abrahamic prophets. There's a famous hadith and tradition of the prophet, where the Prophet says, "Ulama ummati afdal min anbiya'i bani Israel." So they should also be able to cure the sick and heal them with the permission of God. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the power of the Imams to heal. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Documents provided exclusively to the Grey Zone website detail Canberra's abandonment of Julian Assange, an Australian citizen, and provide shocking details of his prison suffering. Stay with us for part one of a two-part article written by Kit Clarenberg, an investigative journalist exploring the role of intelligence services in shaping politics and perceptions. The piece is titled, New Files Expose Australian Government's Betrayal of Julian Assange and Detail His Prison Torment. Was the government of Australia aware of the US Central Intelligence Agency's plot to assassinate Julian Assange, an Australian citizen and journalist, arrested and now imprisoned under unrelenting, bleak, harsh conditions in the United Kingdom? Why have the country's elected leaders refused to publicly advocate for one of its citizens, who, according to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, Niels Meltzer, has been held on dubious charges and subjected to torture by a foreign power? What does Canberra know about Julian Assange's fate, and when did it know it? The Grey Zone website has obtained documents revealing that the Australian government has since day one been well aware of Julian Assange's cruel treatment inside London's maximum security prison at Belmarsh, and has done little or nothing about it. In fact, it has turned a cold shoulder to the jailed journalist, despite hearing his testimony of conditions so bad that his mind was shutting down. Not only has Canberra failed to effectively challenge the American and British governments overseeing Julian Assange's imprisonment and prosecution, as these documents expose in stark detail, it appears to have colluded with them in the flagrant violation of an Australian citizen's human rights, while doing its best to obscure the reality of his situation from the public. In the wake of Yahoo News' startling September revelations of CIA plans to survey, kidnap, and even kill Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, which confirmed and built up a May 2020 expose by the Grey Zone's Max Blumenthal, officials in the NATO-orientated Five Eyes global spying network struggled to get their stories straight. William Evanina, Washington's top counterintelligence officer until his retirement in early 2021, told Yahoo News the Five Eyes alliance was critical to Langley's dastardly plot, and we were very confident that Julian Assange's potential escape from the Ecuadorian embassy in London could be prevented by hook or by crook. However, when asked whether the United States had ever briefed or consulted the government of Julian's native Australia on the operation, Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade dodged the question. For his part, Malcolm Turnbull, the Australian Prime Minister at the time of those deadly deliberations, claimed, "The first I heard about this was in today's media." Elected officials in Canberra claimed that they were kept in the dark about the CIA's proposals. Australian Prime Minister Gough Whitlam said he was unaware of the very existence of Five Eyes until 1973, 17 years after his country became a signatory to the network's underpinning UK-USA agreement. Following police raids on the offices of domestic spying agency, the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, due to its withholding of information from the government. Whether or not Malcolm Turnbull was aware of the operation, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade's response when a member of Julian Assange's family contacted the department demanding Australian Foreign Minister Maurice Payne ask the Biden administration to drop the charges against him and seeking comment on the Yahoo article was disturbingly flippant. A Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade official quipped in a classic non-denial denial, "Just because it's written in a newspaper doesn't mean it's true. The CIA has been accused of a lot of things, including faking the moon landing." These crude remarks were recorded in a letter sent to Maurice Payne by John Shipton, Julian Assange's father. The missive is just one of many documents provided exclusively to Grey Zone by Kelly Tranter, Julian Assange's legal authority in Australia. For years, Kelly Tranter has filed Freedom of Information requests with the Australian government in a campaign to uncover his true position on Julian, and to what extent his intimate alliance with Washington has limited its ability or willingness to push for his freedom. We'll be right back. The documents acquired by Kelly Tranter expose Canberra as anything but an advocate for Julian Assange, an Australian citizen. Instead, throughout Julian Assange's time in the Ecuadorian embassy and imprisonment at Her Majesty's pleasure in Belmarsh High Security Prison, Britain's Guantanamo, the Australian government has been determinedly committed to seeing, hearing and speaking no evil in this regard, despite possessing clear evidence of his dramatically waning physical and mental health and the torturous conditions of his confinement. The records of a brief visit by Australian consulate officers to Belmarsh Prison on 17th of May 2019, 1 month after Assange's dramatic expulsion from the Ecuadorian embassy, are especially illustrative of Canberra's attitude. Over the course of that meeting, Julian Assange spoke in detail about prison conditions and his 23-hour-a-day solitary confinement. The Australian consular officials noted he remains in his cell most of the day, with 40 minutes allocated each day for associations, adding, he's allowed outside for 30 minutes each day, although he said at times this does not happen, for reasons unstated. Unable to eat at all for a long period, he was now ingesting small amounts, collecting meals from the kitchen and returning to his cell. Permitted just 2 personal visits each month, plus legal consultations, Julian Assange mentioned his recent meetings with Niels Meltzer and 2 medical experts specialized in examining potential victims of torture and other ill-treatment, and that he had so far been unable to speak to his family. According to the diplomats, the WikiLeaks co-founder eschewed work programs which could afford him the opportunity to get out of his cell more often, on the grounds that he refused to engage in slave labor and needed time to prepare his legal case. Prisoners in British jails earn an average of $13 per week for hard, thankless toil on behalf of big business, which in turn profits immensely from their rank exploitation. While mercifully prescribed antibiotics and codeine by prison doctors for an infected root canal, which can be life-threatening in the event the infection spreads, Julian Assange was still waiting on reading glasses and had yet to see an optometrist. Adding to his psychological toll, Assange reported that he had undergone blood tests and been advised he was HIV positive, a shocking diagnosis. However, subsequent examinations confirmed the test result to be a false positive, forcing Assange to wonder if the misdiagnosis was a mere error or something else. It could well have been a grotesquely sick mind game, perhaps alluding to the bogus sexual assault allegations he had faced in Sweden and intended to drive him towards madness. Assange also presented the Australian consular officials with a recently published UK Home Office deportation notice, informing him then Secretary of State Sajid Javid had determined under the 1971 UK Immigration Act that his presence in the United Kingdom was not conducive to the public interest, and he will be removed from the United Kingdom without delay, with no chance of appealing the decision. The officer wrote, Mr. Assange expressed concern about surviving the current process and fears he would die if taken to the United States. He said the U.S. was going through his possessions that had remained at the Ecuadorian embassy. He said that this action was illegal. Adding, he stated that his possessions included 2 valuable artworks he planned to sell to raise funds for his legal defense, the manuscripts of 2 books and legal papers. He expressed concern his legal material would be used against him by the United States. Assange was correct that sensitive documents were stolen by U.S. authorities. Immediately following his arrest, his attorney, Gareth Pierce, contacted the Ecuadorian embassy regarding its privileged material, demanding it be handed over as a matter of urgency. When at last his property was collected, all legal papers were missing, save for two volumes of Supreme Court files and a number of pages of loose correspondence, making his extradition defense an even greater challenge than it already was. Over the course of Julian Assange's initial extradition hearings in early 2020, Assistant U.S. Secretary for the Eastern District of Virginia, Gordon Cromberg, implausibly pledged a taint team would exercise material from these files so it would not be used in any resultant trial. Similarly, feeble assurances of this ilk were offered during the recent appeal proceedings. Despite his situation, Julian Assange somehow retained a vague shred of optimism about the future in discussions with consular officials, suggesting that the result of Australia's federal election, which was held the very next day, may present a window for a new government to do something supportive for his case, asking that Foreign Minister Maurice Payne be briefed on developments. As it was, Scott Morrison's Liberal National Coalition retained its grip on power, and no alarm was publicly raised about anything learned over the course of the consular visit. Indeed, remaining tight-lipped on Julian Assange's suffering, no matter how horrendous, was to be a matter of dedicated policy. Well, dear listeners, that was the first part of Kit Clarenberg's article, New Files Expose Australian Government's Betrayal of Julian Assange and Detail His Prison Torment. Tune in tomorrow for the second part of this two-part article.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
In the modern
era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like this dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago, while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America, and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water, and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further because, in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient who's bleeding profusely and saying, "Oh, it's not so bad." When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea.
Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anane. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana.
this is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to meet you. Councillor Leo Blackburn, if you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the asset tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste. They have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa? Or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana.
Mm.
Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched, as far as we can, that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago. And, as I said, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it... He's no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anani. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. Are you happy? Is anybody around?
Sorry, at the moment, it's basically two institutions have gone into administration. We've been taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call OZEN.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses has been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belén Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Len and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for €2. A fridge will yield up to €10 and a system unit €4. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, €10 million. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belén's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belén's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the third world? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals and prisons, and even the gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled, but D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering 3 continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors have been sold for between 50 cents and 2 euros apiece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo in Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced and their fake recycling company shut down. But Mobo continued to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends 130 billion euros a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver, and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. 50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about 40,000 euros. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. In January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbours. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Anane has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years, we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute so that we can't be there to check, or potentially having material in the first few rows of the container that are working order, but some material sitting behind that that's not working order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use the resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
You were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to get to the end of the container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. But we've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the controls that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. What about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity. What most people don't know is that a lot of US e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler, they'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
Wang Yuji is 11 months old and has become an internet sensation after a video of her snowboarding went viral in China. Wang Yuji is a daredevil infant snowboarder whose adorable face sticks out from underneath all of the protective snow and sports gear. Her parents decided to learn skiing during the winter, but they also wanted to include their baby in the fun of snow sports. While snowboarding might be a bit too early for a toddler who can barely stand or walk, Yuji wasn't scared at all and even enjoyed it. China, which is hosting the Winter Olympics in a couple of months, is encouraging citizens to try ice and snow sports. Every year, the roads across this tiny island in northwestern Australia turn scarlet just as millions of crabs leave their homes in the depths of the forest and start marching together all the way to the ocean where they can mate and spawn. The spectacular group voyage on Christmas Island happens after the first rainfall in October or November. And in order to give these red creatures the leeway, locals close off multiple roads across the island. They've even built a special bridge for the crabs so that they can cross the road unharmed. The mesmerizing migration is now a tourist attraction, drawing nature lovers from around the globe.
Paleontologists in Brazil have discovered remains that could belong to a species of dinosaur as yet unknown. The fossils were found at a site in northeastern Brazil. A team of scientists is trying to put together the bones and complete the huge dinosaur's skeleton. They think it lived during the Cretaceous period, which began around 145 million years ago, and ended with extinction of all dinosaurs roughly 66 million years ago.
A new study shows that moderate consumption of tea and coffee may be better for your health than previously thought. The study conducted by a Chinese medical university says tea and coffee can help keep stroke and dementia at bay. And if you're wondering what is meant by moderate consumption, it's defined as something between 2 and 5 cups of tea and coffee, either alone or combined in one day. The study followed more than 360,000 people aged 50 to 74 for over a decade. Some scientists have praised the study as robust. Others, however, say the participants were all selected from the UK Biobank, which means they're healthier than the general population. pomegranate has a special place in Iranian culture. There is a trace of the fruit everywhere from poetry to cooking. Iranians even hold a pomegranate festival in the fall. This year the event is held in one of the main parks in the capital, Tehran. The festival features different varieties of pomegranates that are grown across Iran. The visitors can also find pomegranate products, including juices, concentrates, and dressings. The event includes cultural parades, music concerts, and traditional live performances. Iranians say they always welcome the pomegranate season, as it's one of the old symbols in the country's literature and art. The Christmas season always brings happiness and joy to people around the world. Many Parisians these days are taking a respite from their daily routines and hitting famous departmental stores now light up with present boxes. Cheerful families could be spotted at Christmas-decorated galleries, Lafayette and Printemps department stores. Automated figures and colorful window displays are the center of attractions for them and their children. It's a season when people buy Christmas gifts for their loved ones and stores make big profits this time around. Many Parisians say they want to take advantage of this period as the government is debating whether or not to impose a COVID-related lockdown. In Venezuela, a large number of musicians are striving for one common goal, and that's setting the Guinness record as the world's largest orchestra. Over 12,000 musicians, mostly children and adolescents, have played together to make that happen. Hundreds of violins, violas, and double basses playing in unison at this setting in Caracas. The musicians are all connected to the country's network of youth orchestras. For them to set a record, over 8,000 instruments had to play at the same time during a 5-minute period of a classical piece. Right now, a Russian orchestra that played the country's national anthem is holding the record. Once done, the crowd of musicians erupted in cheers, lifting their instruments and waving Venezuelan flags. Guinness will announce its decision in the next 10 days. Tourists and residents in Los Angeles have been mesmerized by a dazzling new event the U.S. city is hosting with holiday-themed and full of colorful lights. Visitors can enjoy a mile-long walkway covered on all sides with brightly lit installations. Artists from around the world have taken part in the exhibition. The centerpiece display is a cathedral tunnel lit with thousands of bulbs. Another amazing attraction is the orbs, lit up with thousands of torches. The event has been a huge hit with the LA public.
Oh my gosh, it's so nice.
And it gets to be out in the open, and it's like a perfect night to do it, so it's great.
It's definitely the best. Like, we had to do, like, in a car to go see lights, and then we got to, like, now, like, go around and actually walk and get to see everything up close, which is super nice.
Yeah.
Definitely after the, what, year and a half that we've had.
Yeah.
So.
And it's really nice to see everything up close, because it's like, you see in a photo, but then it's more real and real, so.
Yeah.
The event opened to the public on the 12th of November and will run for 5 nights. Preparations for the event, however, started a month ago. The organizers say millions of bulbs and 17 miles of cables are used for the 18 art installations.
From a gray and gloomy look to a cheery and colorful appearance. That's the story of how a neighborhood in Peru's capital, Lima, is being transformed to become a tourist attraction.
A group of artists in Lima are bringing color and joy to this hilly neighborhood by painting the walls of houses, creating an optical illusion of a giant mural. The project is visible from different spots across the city. The designers are hoping what they did can improve the lives of residents in a neighborhood that was considered to be unsafe before.
What we are doing here is communal work with all the neighbors, and we are doing it because it's important to change the environment through the use of colors. This hill was considered an unsafe and dangerous area of the city, so we decided to change that social stigma through art, which, for me as a muralist, is the best tool to achieve it.
The project was started 5 months ago, and workers are now putting the final touches to their work of art. The mural covers over 300,000 square meters. It's the largest in South America.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The birth of a baby sloth at an uncharacteristically hasty speed has surprised London zookeepers. A tiny two-toed sloth named Terrier was born to a mother, Marilyn, at the weekend. The zookeepers say there was no sign at all that Marilyn was going into labor when they checked her in the morning. However, less than an hour, they spotted something like a tiny arm tucked into her tummy. Marilyn had quietly delivered the baby with no fuss at all, while her keepers were chopping up sweet potatoes for her breakfast. The mother and baby are said to be doing well, but the zookeepers still don't know the sex of the baby.
Modern technology has changed our lives in countless ways, with robots now preparing to lend a hand in operation rooms. Surgical robots are on display at the 4th China International Import Expo. One of the machines, dubbed Mesa X, gives assistance in spinal surgery. Employing the robot can lessen bleeding by 50% compared to open surgeries. Another one assists doctors to perform interventional surgeries.
Guide valves in the vessels can be controlled even less than 1 millimeter. This is not cannot be achieved by the human hands. With the great, I think, market impact from this showcase, we successfully performed a first case PCI in Hainan Boao on March 13th.
The producers say surgical robots will soon operate in more hospitals around China. Therefore, training centers have been established to help surgeons learn how to operate the new generation of surgical robots.
A tigress belonging to the endangered Bengal species has given birth to four cubs at the Mexican Zoo, bringing joy and hope to wildlife enthusiasts. The four were born in the San Jorge Park in the city of Ciudad Juarez on October 10th. Nearly a month on, they are in good health. That is good news, because usually when multiple cubs are born, not all of them survive. Zoo officials have not yet determined the sex of the newborn cubs. That is because their mother lets out a roar when the vets are nearby. Bengal tigers are endangered for two reasons: poaching and the destruction of their natural habitat. Here's what you can call killing two birds with one stone. Classic car lovers have gone on an exciting rally to see an erupting volcano. The event, organized by Beshbok Rallies, happened on a Saturday. Motorists taking part in the vintage rally had the unique opportunity to witness a volcano erupting ash and smoke. Most of the participants tried to get as close as they could to the volcano, but there were also those who chose to take other vehicles because they were afraid that their precious antique cars would be damaged.
Often, it does not take much to bring about positive social change. In Johannesburg, a group of painters are creating artworks on the trolleys of street recyclers. Reason? To encourage bystanders to look up and notice the work recyclers, locally known as reclaimers, do in the community.
I like my work to have meaning, so when I get to paint and become a part of a project like this, it's great for me, you know? Because it's not every day we get to like do stuff like this, so yeah.
Up until now, they were just filthy-looking jumbo bags with recyclable waste wheeling along the streets. But thanks to graffiti artists who are giving them a makeover with bold and bright designs to help identify and protect the recyclers, artists say their goal is to build a relationship between neighborhood residents and waste pickers. The reclaimers roam around the city day and night, with some motorists even considering them a risk, as the trolleys are not always visible. There are some 6,000 reclaimers in Johannesburg who make a living collecting, sorting, recycling garbage. It's a messy job, but they do it anyway. A group of women are joining hands to protect one of India's key natural sites that is also on UNESCO's heritage list, the Western Ghats, a mountain chain that's facing severe deforestation. The 27 members of this all-female task force are doing all they can to protect the area's rare ferns, mosses, and thousands of other plants. They're using a variety of gardening tools and techniques to preserve species from all over the mountains. Not only that, but they also make artificial conditions and habitats for endangered species from other parts of the world, mainly those affected by climate change. One of the conservationists explained that what they are doing is actually helping the forest regenerate.
We have witnessed the birth of a forest, and that's a very powerful thing. You know, the mind is filled with the ghastly stories of forests being cut, like the Amazon or like the Western Ghats, but here we're witness to the birth of forests as well, and that is the forest itself birthing itself, you see.
The Western Ghats Mountains are home to nearly 5,000 species of flowering plants, but many of them are globally threatened. Only less than half of the area's flora is currently under conservation. Scientists say the outlook for the mountain is very concerning.
IRIB English Radio.